Good afternoon, everyone. Please may I ask you to take your seats as our next session is about to begin. Our next session features Joerg Esser, CFO of Danone, hosted by Bernstein analyst Bruno Monteyne. And if you have any questions, you can scan the QR code on the second page of your pamphlet. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Joerg, for joining us today to talk about Danone. If somebody could scan the back screen with the QR code, because I know many of you want to ask questions to Danone as well, you can scan that, you can put your question in the pigeonhole, and I'll make sure we keep enough time for those at the end. I think Joerg will open with some pre-prepared remarks, is that correct? And then we'll go in the fireside chat.
Thank you, Bruno. Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. We'll not bore you with too many prepared remarks, but just wanted to give you the 60-second version of where we are as a company. Since we relaunched and launched our strategy, which is kind of 18 months ago, last year in March. What you have seen over the last 18 months basically is a new strategy, a new governance with a board which has been entirely renewed, which is today probably one of the, I would say, best boards in the CAC 40, if I may say. A new executive committee with a number of, I would say, world-class experts joining the executive committee on operations, on R&I. A new operating model with a better balance between categories and local insights. And that all leading to the fact that we have been very intentionally in this focus managing our portfolio on the three dimensions, managing what we are calling our underperformers, selling a number of them, starting to fix a number of them, including in China, Mizone, boosting what we call our winners, clinical nutrition, becoming a bigger and bigger part of our business, but also everything, and I'm sure we talk about it, you know, today, our high-protein products, and then taking care of the core. And as we know, if you don't take care of the core, all the rest is meaningless. And so we are making very good progress taking care of the core, and the core basically especially being what we have in Europe in dairy. 18 months down the road, a lot has happened, and now we are starting to see the benefits kicking in. For those of you who have been following us in the first semester results, you saw that gross margin start to act, gross margin up big time. We are walking the talk on reinvestment, so a very important part of the gross margin upside we are reinvesting into the business in order to get the flywheel really spin. And the second element, which is just in front of us, is to make sure that those reinvestments on an optimized portfolio is also delivering volume and mix growth. So that's the milestone in front of us to get really into that value creation model we are aiming for, which we have been describing 18 months ago. Last sentence, and then I will go to your questions, is that you have, during those 18 months, the environment was not what we thought it would be, because we basically launched our strategy at the beginning of the Ukrainian war. We didn't expect necessarily the inflationary tsunami we had over the last 18 months, and we have been just consistent in execution, been walking the talk 18 months exactly on what we said in Evian in March of last year, and that's exactly what we want to do in the coming quarters and years, walking the talk. So we are very happy where we are today with the results, and this is the way we want to progress.
Thank you, Nathan. Now, if you think about the core brand that you talked about, I think you and Antoine have been quite clear in the past, it's all about repositioning the brands. And if I sort of use my own language, a few years ago, consumers considered Danone yogurt as just some mass market fruity little box on the supermarket shelf. You're trying to reposition those. Let's say Activia, it's meant to be gut health, Actimel for immunity. So you're almost trying to, you know, I think Antoine said the doctor should prescribe yogurts, right? So your products. And so these are interesting ways of thinking about brands, and on paper they can see how all of that works. Now, obviously, it can be hard to make work. And I'm thinking about another one you did about the not milk. So I think you explained to us a little while ago, Alpro is too much focused on ingredients. It makes it sound very commoditized. If one is almond and soya milk, so we'll make not milk, take away, and think about functional benefits. So that would have been, I think, the first version of your repositioning brands with an interesting concept. Did that Alpro rebrand launch of not milk, do you feel that's working, particularly in the UK or in other places?
Yeah, so there's many questions in what you are saying, obviously. Maybe let me talk about dairy and plant-based in Europe, which I think is at the heart of many of the conversations we are having with the markets and with our investors. On dairy, particularly in Europe, we are coming out of a decade long where we have not been supporting our portfolio. 10 years ago, we stopped to claim the benefits of our portfolio, so we became, what you say, a yogurt on the shelf, not very differentiated. And so with the portfolio repositioning over the last 18 months, what we have been doing is to refocus our portfolio where we have truly a differentiated offer to the consumer, which is true for Activia, which is true for Actimel, which is true for what we have been launching 3 weeks ago in the U.K., which is a high-protein product, which I really recommend you to try, 25 grams of protein with almost no calories. So products which are really different from what competition is doing and products which are really different from what private label can do. This is putting us in a position to, again, communicate on this product, and it's putting us in a position to demand a premium pricing. This is all nice on the paper, on the PowerPoint. This is all nice in storytelling. In the end, you want to see it translating into results, right? So as we are in the U.K., when you look at the U.K. shelf, today the U.K. shelf in dairy is not looking as it looked 12 months ago, and in 12 months, it will not look like it is today. What I mean with that, you go as a consumer on the shelf, and you don't know how to orientate yourself on the shelf because you have a number of brands, benefits are not clear. So if you want something which helps you for immunity, you don't know where to find it. If you want something which is good for your gut health, you don't know where to find it. So we've been working with the retailers in the U.K., but in all the European countries, to convince them to bring an order on the shelf, to make sure the consumer finds easier what the consumer is looking for. So we did tests with different retailers, tests in the U.K., tests in France, tests in Germany, tests in Spain, in order to demonstrate that in the moment that you segment the shelf by benefit, the rotation on the shelf is increasing. Good news, all those tests were positive, which means that we are rolling out, as we speak, that segmentation of the shelf. Why are we able to do it? Because despite all what happened through many years in Danone, we are still the category captain in many of the markets. So we have the right to propose that to the retailer, and the retailer is seeing it works. So the fact that they are now replicating what has been proven to be a success story is, I think, a first very important milestone for us, because what it will deliver us is more distribution, more share of shelf. This is measurable elements. So when I go back to the U.K. example, now since a couple of months, distribution is increasing. Now since a couple of months, share of shelf is increasing. Now is the moment to put marketing money behind because you want to make sure that this share of shelf also drives velocities. Team is doing an excellent job. James and John, who are taking care of that year execution in the U.K., brilliant, and we are building the conditions to grow in volume and in share, and I think we will see that coming in the not-so-far future. So that's one, and very important. This was enabled, and then I go to the plant-based question, by the fact that we have been streamlining the portfolio, I may say, in a brutal manner over the last 12 months. We really took a very short period of time to take out of the portfolio where we are not competitive, where we were not profitable. Usually, you stretch that over many years. We took the decision to do it over 12 months, and we are coming to the end of that story. So Q3 is the last quarter. We will see the impact of that in our top line. So from Q3 onwards, from Q4 onwards, we will see that the baseline will be a much different baseline. The portfolio will be an optimized portfolio. So we have everything in our hands to grow that portfolio. That's on dairy. Plant-based, Alpro, market leader in Europe, a category which has been extremely volatile, let's face it, throughout the last 3-4 years. It was a category which was booming over many years, was even more booming during COVID for a simple reason, which is people were home. They made their cappuccino at home, so they bought their soy, their almonds, their oat milk, and they prepared their cappuccino at home or their latte at home. They went back to the office, less consumption. And this is a very mechanic element. There's two elements of good news. First good news, penetration of households. So the number of households consuming plant-based dairy alternatives is continuing to increase. In the U.K., in Europe, in the U.S. So the fundamentals of the category are very sound. Frequency is now going back to growth after this COVID peak Now it's going back to growth. So the category is healthy. What is important for us is to make a better job in that category. And I think we are walking the talk here, and then we come to the innovation points you were asking me. We are walking the talk on two different elements. One element is better execution. We need to be where the consumer is, and where the consumer is looking for those products. First of all, in coffee shops, in coffee chains, because this is where the trend has been born. You go today to one of the four biggest coffee chains in the UK, you will find iPro. That was not the case 12 months ago. That's very important. Brand building, awareness, because this is also what will be reflected in share in the supermarkets. Second element, innovation. Today, the category is still very classic. An oat milk, a soy milk, an almond milk. We truly believe that we need to bring innovations into that space. Benefit-led innovations. We have been experimenting with a number of elements. We are not yet happy with it. There is still work to do, but we feel confident that it's in our hands. We are the largest player. We are by far the one who has the best technology in-house. Most of our competition is sourcing from third-party producers. And thirdly, we have the marketing capabilities and science capabilities. So we have everything in our hand to make sure that we are getting innovations into the market which will truly step change the category and make sure that we continue on a sustainable growth trend.
So I'm going to dig a bit deeper on that nut milk, because I can sort of see the overall point in the category, but nut milk was meant to be an example of how you can rebrand, move away from the commodities. When I look at the shelf, you have three times more shelf space for competing nut milk brands. There's even private labeled nut milk. So, I mean, if you were a bear, you would argue, look, even nut milk, it gets copied faster than you can roll it out, and it's not strongly presented on the shelf. So did nut milk work? And if so, you know, what did you learn from it?
Yeah, I think there's a number of learnings we took over the last 18 months. Because nut milk as a proposition which is not an oat milk. It's the best out of plant-based products with the best taste as close as possible to cow milk. It's an incredible proposition. Because what people are looking for is a milk which is tasting as cow milk, but they're giving you different benefits, right? So you look at the UK, I would say the results are average. We are not happy. You look at Germany working very well because we were able to better explain the product. So we need now to replicate what works in those countries where it works to the other countries. I truly believe that the more benefit-led proposition vis-a-vis an ingredient-led proposition is the future of that market. So we are looking with confidence into that.
Now, gut health, as the key label for Activia, one of your biggest brands, what gives you the confidence that defining something as gut health will be the enabler? You know, what data do you have rather than calling it yogurt?
Yeah, I think when you look, you do some very basic statistic assessments, and you look at social media and the noise which is grounded around the fact that the health of your gut is the health of your body. It was a conversation which hardly existed 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Type today gut health in social media, the number of discussions and conversations around it is exploding. So gut health is very high in the awareness of the consumer, and there's nothing better than a yogurt for gut health. So how can we make sure that with Activia particularly, we play a pioneering role in this? We were pioneers 10 years ago because we were the first ones talking about it and we were the first ones claiming around it. Then we stopped claiming. Then we became a fruit yogurt than any other fruit yogurt. Now we are back to claiming because we have science behind. And as we are claiming, we will advertise behind it because people need to be aware. If you don't talk about it, how can people know? So having succeeded with the fact that we have retailers now implementing the planograms for the shelf, creating a gut health section in across all Europe, making sure that Activia is the most prominent brand in that element, and advertising behind it will be the key to success. I have absolutely no doubt about it. What is important, and this is in our own hands, is to have perfect execution. And that means that we do not do what we did over the last couple of years, which is 10 different executions of marketing in 10 different countries in Europe. So you were in Germany, you were looking at different advertising than in France, in a different advertising in UK, but having one expression of the brand, one design, one packaging, and one advertising so that you can create scale and consistency, And retailers are very well receiving that, and so we have all the support for that. So I think we have everything in our hand to make it happen. The reinvestment is important. because we are a branded product player. We are not private label, which means that we need to invest behind our brands. We had basically zero investments in dairy over the last years. Going back and putting significant money again behind our brands will change the dynamics in the dairy industry, on the shelf, and for us.
We talked previously about the UK supermarket pictures we recently published. They were not there yet, but I must admit, when I go to the US, shelf execution is a lot more respectful to your brands, your competing brands. They're well-respected, well-laid-down. You're able to communicate them. Is there any structural reason why it's easier and why you are able in the US to get the retailers to adhere to what you want to say rather than in Europe?
No. I mean, the short answer is no. The long answer will be that in the US, we started earlier. You know that already 2 years ago, we started in the US the journey. We started only a bit less than 1 year ago in Europe. So in that sense, we are again doing the same job. What is important is that you want to be perfect in execution where the category is. And I'm saying that when you go to a UK, you have thousands of supermarkets in the UK. You have less than 2,000 where the dairy category is really. So if you want to play in dairy, you need to be in less than 2,000 supermarkets. This is what to be perfect in execution. So our strategy is to go to these less than 2,000 supermarkets and to implement what we call the PCOS, the picture of success, and we are going very fast on that. So by the end of the year, we'll have rolled out picture of success in the UK across all of those a bit less than 2,000 supermarkets, which will be an incredible springboard for growth in the future.
Now, you say there's no structural reason in the US. Let me try to push back. In the US, private label is not just smaller, but it plays a different role. Walmart isn't trying to compete by having the best yogurt. If I look at the UK, Marks & Spencer, Sainsbury's, very developed yogurt. It's a part of their brand identity as a supermarket. Is displayed through fresh categories because quality comes in freshness. So clearly, European supermarkets have learned the art of yogurt, using it as a critical part of their competition with each other. Hence, that might make it harder for Danone to compete. Wouldn't that be a structural reason why it's easier to land in the US than in Europe?
I don't believe so. So first, you are right that it's not a one-to-one comparison for many reasons. First, the consumption is different in the US than in Europe. In the US, yogurt is a snacking occasion. In Europe, it's more dessert. So you take it after lunch, you take it after dinner. So it's a very different way the consumer is looking at the category. The second element is that the portfolio we are having in Europe and the US is very different. And even inside of Europe, you have some differences. In the UK, like in Germany, we focus on premium. We focus on truly functional benefits. Activia, Actimel, high protein, kids range. This is where we are focusing and which makes us truly different than the competitors of local dairy, which are mostly on the commoditized product range. In markets like France and Spain, where we have basically been creating the category, we have a more complete portfolio. What is similar in all of those cases is in Europe is that we are the category captain. We are the category confronted usually versus local players who do not invest into marketing, who do not have the expertise, who have not the science. Let me give you an example, and I took this beautiful bottle again. So putting 25 grams of protein into that bottle, it's an art. Because it means you need to be able to compact protein. We can do this because we have a medical nutrition business where protein compactization is part of the proposition when you are a cancer patient, when you are a stroke patient. So you will see that we will move more and more into a direction which is highly sophisticated products for certain benefits which will not be easily copied by competition, which will make us truly unique in that space. And so in that sense, I believe that in the US, where we are going exactly in that way, it's nothing different than in Europe. And in the end, it's about execution on the shelf with the retailer. And our conversations with the retailer today are not anymore what it was 12 months ago, which was about price. Today, we talk about innovation, brand investment, more share of shelf, and us proposing the plan of the shelf, so it's a fundamental shift here.
Your shift to the functional benefits, the examples you gave, there's somewhat higher value add than what you did before. Given that we're in a cost of living crisis, is the worst possible moment to do this?
I agree and I disagree. What is interesting when you look at the consumer, and by the way, it's in Europe and in North America, the shopping behaviors are changing. So the consumer is more careful and conscious on the way it's spending its money. Which are the channels today which are booming? and this is across the two continents. The channels today which are booming are discounters, club stores, so in the US you go to Costco or Walmart, and surprise, away from home. The channel which is growing today the fastest in our portfolio is away from home. It's not the biggest channel today, growing very, very fast, which means that the consumer is willing to spend money in the right occasion, in the right channel. When you go today to an airport, a train station, a gym, wherever, you will find our product. Very high priced, super premium, fast growth. And at the same moment, we need to make sure that we are also where the consumer goes in order to manage his pocket. In discounters, but with the right proposition. In club stores, with the right proposition. And I think we have been anticipating that in a good manner 18 months ago, and we have been adapting what we call our price pack architecture to it. So I believe that today we have a portfolio which is exactly addressing these two spectrums. But it's not only about low price. People do not want to have private label only. They want to have a meaningful brand in front of them which gives them an extra benefit. And the benefit can be a functional benefit, good for my health, or an emotional benefit because they want to feel good. The reality is that when today my wife who loves mousse au chocolat, I mean, obviously, when you have a proposition under High Pro, which is almost zero fat, zero calories, but gives you all the pleasure of a mousse au chocolat, that's an incredible proposition. So how do you make sure that you have the right offers in front of the consumers on what he or she is looking for? And so I believe that we need to play both spectrums, the low price and the high price.
You've always been quite clear that there's different phases, you know, redesign the brand, do the range rationalization, get the shelves ready. And at some point, you're going to open the floodgates of A&P to drive consumers to it. Have things slipped? Because I feel like we've had Antoine here last year. We've had discussions before. And Antoine has been for quite a while. Is it on track? And is it anytime soon that you will see the new shelves and the floodgates of A&P driving us back to it?
I'm sure we will not flood it because that sounds like a non-disciplined allocation. But first semester, reinvestment, almost 100 bips. Tell me one player in our industry who has been reinvesting 100 bips, the majority of it going into AMP. So we are walking the talk. We have been starting to reinvest second semester of last year, huge reinvestment first semester of this year. I think we are moving faster than even what we thought 18 months ago, then in a very disciplined manner, because it's not like, you know, just flooding the space with AMP. We need to do it in a manner which is return-oriented. And so what we have been doing over the last 12 months is to put the money where we are ready to put the money. We've been heavily reinvesting into specialized nutrition, and it's paying because we are winning across the segments in specialized nutrition. We've been strongly reinvesting into the U.S. market, and it's paying. We've been strongly reinvesting into Evian, into Maison in China. It's paying. We are winning share. And we are now, as we speak, in the second semester, investing in Europe and dairy. So we are exactly walking the talk. And what you will see in the second semester is what you saw in the first semester, strong reinvestment, a lot of A&P focused, but also focused on a portfolio which is much more streamlined, and where we are making sure that we are getting a return. And just if I can expand on that 30 seconds more, because that's important. When you are in Spain in a portfolio in dairy with 13 brands and you spend $1 million, and 12 months later you still spend $1 million but on 5 brands because you have been optimizing the portfolio by just spending the same amount, the impact you will have will be much higher. So what we have been making sure in Europe, first and foremost, is having the right portfolio and going where we have the highest returns. And now we go to the next step. And I think that will, again, that will trigger results. And when I talk about results, in the end, what is results? Results is not a good story. Results means, in the end, distribution, frequency, market shares, volumes. And we are walking exactly that talk, and that's very transparent. Distribution starts to go up, frequency starts to go up. You will see market share following and volumes.
I'm trying to combine a few bits of your answers from the last 10 minutes, but you know, you sort of saying yogurt, Europe is sort of the last one to get that investment. You've seen our pictures of the UK. You're saying by the end of the year, we should see different shelves in the UK and a few more countries, supported by major A&P, and that's sort of the proof point to suggest.
Absolutely, but the good news, it's measurable. So it's not storytelling, it will be hard numbers. And that's the beauty of execution, that it's not subjective, it's really something you can measure with clear data points.
And would it be fair to say the clear data points are sustained volume market share gains?
The objective is to go into a cycle of sustained market share gains, which translates into volume growth. And this is exactly what we explained 18 months ago, that we want to go into that balanced growth profile, volume, mix, price, particularly for the dairy category, because it will change our life.
And from quarter one next year, you think that should be what we're looking forward to?
Well, even better than that, because we are here also walking the talk. What we said in February or March was that what you will see is the first semester of this year, where in EDP, in Europe, the volumes will be still down because we are cleaning the portfolio. And from the second semester onwards, you will see volume dynamics changing. We are exactly in line with what we said here, and see absolutely, and we have created the conditions to make that happen.
We have the Evian sparkling water. You've been very clear, you're trying to premiumize, getting the sparkling version. I see you more and more in train stations, the on-the-go that you
Yes.
were just mentioning before. If we think about premiumizing Evian, what kind of price uplift are you aiming for, and how far are you in the process
Yeah.
of premiumizing Evian?
Yeah. That's an amazing business. For those of you, and I need to do 20 seconds of marketing, for those of you who have never been to Evian, please come and visit us, because once you have been to see the impluvium of 30 square kilometers of protected landscape, where 15 years after the water is coming out of the mountains, you will not drink anything else anymore than Evian. And we're going to talk about that more and more. After that teaser for the Evian brand. So yes, we are on a premiumization strategy, which is a premiumization strategy which is to go more and more to premium outlets. So yes, we need to be in supermarkets. Yes, we need to be in modern retail, but much more important for us is to be in away from home, on the go, premium HoReCa. And this is what you are seeing, and this is what you are seeing more and more, because today we have the assets to do so. While in the past we had only a still water proposition, now we have an Evian sparkling, so we have now the couple which makes us enter premium HoReCa. We have started in export markets, as we call it, in the U.K., in the U.S., in Asia. We get very good benefits here and feedbacks, and you will see us now rolling it out. We will do it in a very intentional manner, because what we want to do is to bring awareness from the consumer through these premium occasions in hotels and restaurants, in order then to launch it into the supermarkets in a second phase, so that it's truly able to demand a premium price. The beauty of it is that we can complement it with local offers, and this is why I put also the Harrogate water here, which those of you who are living in the U.K., you may be familiar with. Amazing brand, 100 years plus heritage. We are already here in many of premium outlets. So having a local proposition and an international proposition will help us manage the portfolio and to be at every occasion, at every outlet where we want to be, and we believe there's a big, big opportunity here.
Before COVID, everybody would have asked you about challenger brands and niche brands that were gaining share
Yes.
for all FMCG companies. They somewhat disappeared off the radar during COVID. When I was visiting your shelf recently, I did suddenly pick up loads of new brands I'd never heard of before. Do you notice a change in the resurgence of challenger brands again in the market or not?
Not really, to be honest. I believe that there's one important component which is bringing a bit of normality into the conversations, which is that you launch today a new brand. When you are a startup company, you cannot afford anymore to lose 10 years' money. It's true that in a number of spaces, including in plant-based, we were competing with people who didn't need to make money, who were burning money every month, every quarter, every year. Those times are over, which means that the way retailers are receiving you, they want to see innovations, but they want to see scalable innovations, and they want to see scalable innovations where the producer is willing and able to put serious money behind. So we are seeing a much more, I would say, healthy traction in the discussion with the retailers, which I think is good news. Good news for the consumer, it's good news for the retailers. For us, when you talk about us, we have been also proliferating innovations for long. Putting meaningless innovation on the shelf, they were dying 6 or 12 months later. Nobody is winning from that. It's very exciting for the consumer because he will try once, but he will not come back a second time. Nobody is winning in that. We have been totally shifting our innovation focus. We've been cutting our innovation pipeline by 30%, We have been setting the bar much higher on what a good innovation looks like, because good innovation means has a clear position vis-à-vis the consumer and a meaningful impact on our P&L. And this is changing our life and also in the conversation with the retailer, because this is what the retailer is looking for. And last point is, what does the retailer want? The retailer wants a product which gives a good absolute margin for every unit sold. This is what you need to come with, something which can grow and something which gives a good margin to us and to the retailer.
One of your areas of success is China infant nutrition, you know, whether it's competition, you've done extremely well for quite a few years. Now, the only thing that doesn't look as good is if you look at your margin development over the last 5 years, even excluding the kind of redefinition, it's been steadily declining by a few hundred basis points. What gives you confidence that the five-year decline in profitability of specialized nutrition has bottomed out?
I think we have a very good level of profitability in specialized nutrition, and I think it's on a sustainable level. We are in a very intentional way rebalancing the portfolio. You talk about China. In China, we have three legs. We have even four legs, you can say, in China. We have an early life nutrition business, 23 billion euro category, a massive category, in which we have a 10% share today, where we've been growing share quarter by quarter, quarter by quarter. It's not by coincidence, but because we've been very intentionally driving our portfolio, driving our business model, protecting our profitability in a category which is truly transforming. In that category, 5 years ago, you had 800 players. By the end of the year, probably 100. Big consolidation happening in the market. We have an incredible portfolio today. We got all our innovations validated by the local regulator. We have an impressive portfolio moving on, which will make us win. And which will make us win in a business model, which I believe, where we can sustain margins. More important than that is the fact that we have an incredible clinical portfolio in China, which is growing very fast, double digit, quarter by quarter, quarter by quarter. Baby medical nutrition, with more and more people and babies born with certain needs, allergies and so on, there's more and more need for these products. Much less competition, more sophisticated, more medical, growing very fast, beautiful business, at least as profitable as early life nutrition. Adult clinical nutrition, probably even a more beautiful business, because we are spot on trend in China and outside of China. We are number one in enteral tube feeding. We are 90% of Chinese tier one hospitals. We have an incredible route to market. We just got drug license, what we are calling a drug license, for oral nutrition, medical nutrition. And we are one of a few who can say that. So we can now truly leverage this route to market in China. Profit margins at least as high, if not more interesting than an early life nutrition, because it's more sophisticated as a product. So you will see us very fast rebalancing our profit pool within China between what's the early life nutrition and the more medicalized products. At the same moment, we will grow very fast our profitability outside of China. So one is to build resilience, structural resilience in China, but at the same moment, we are moving very fast on fixing the underperformers outside of China. Especially in emerging markets, fixing a number of business models, all what we do in Europe, so that we will rebalance sequentially our profit pools away from what today many people talk about, EL in China. I think there's a misperception here also, because I think some people are of the impression that EL in China is like 25% of our profitability of this company. Absolutely not. We are closer to 15 than to 25%, and this is rebalancing in a very fast manner, not by decreasing profitability in China, in EL, but by growing very fast the profit pool outside of this area.
But despite all the good news you've mentioned, the margins are going down, so there's something missing in that story of success.
The margins are going down on specialized nutrition because of one important element, which is that in specialized nutrition, we have two different channels. You have a prescribed channel, a non-prescribed channel. And these prescribed channels are different country by country, depending on local regulations. When you look over the last 12 months, where we were confronted with heavy inflation, getting a price increase on prescribed channels takes time. And it can take time between 6 months to 18 months. So you will see margin bouncing very nicely back, especially in Europe, where we have a lot of prescription in specialized nutrition. Now I'm very confident on margin profile in specialized nutrition.
Danone has always been committed to sustainability from the very early days.
Yes.
now you have stringent targets. So it's quite surprising to see that NGO, I think it's Client Earth, suing you for not sticking to your plastics commitment. So are you on track with the commitments you made on plastics packaging?
Yes, we are. And I think you have seen us, and that's very important to us. When we launched the strategy 18 months ago, we also took time to make sure that our sustainability ambitions go along that strategy. So we launched at the beginning of the year what we call the Danone Impact Journey, with a couple of beliefs. With the first belief, which is when you want to have a true impact on the planet, on nutrition, on the health, you need to focus and you need to focus your impact because there's only so much resources you can invest, right? And we realized that we had too many commitments in too many areas where our impact as an industry and as a category leader was not where we thought it could be. So we have been refocusing. When it goes to plastic, to be very concrete, on plastic, we have a number of commitments. First of all, you want to reduce the plastic you use, right? Reducing virgin plastic. So we took a commitment to decrease by 30% by 2030, which is not in 30 years from now, but which is in 7 years from now. We're exactly on track. We reduced, I think, 70,000 tons of our virgin plastic. When you look at our Actimel, which was the latest innovation we brought, our Actimel bottle, we took out the sleeve. It saves as a hell of plastic. It makes it 100% recyclable. It's one of the examples where we're just walking the talk. So the bottle is lighter, no sleeve, perfect contribution. So virgin plastic reduction on track. Second element, probably equally important, making it 100% recyclable. Very important, because if you don't make it recyclable, it cannot be truly circular. We are today at 83-84% of level of recyclability. We go to 100. We are walking the talk on that. I mean, we are already on waters almost there, because when you drink today an Evian or Volvic, you are on 100% recyclable bottle. And by the way, recycled material bottle. On dairy, we still have a job to do, but this will go also very fast. We are walking the talk. The third element is more complex, because it's not only in our hands. It's about really generating a circular model, which means you have a bottle which is recyclable. How do you get it back once it's consumed? And this is where in a number of countries like Indonesia, like Mexico, we have been supporting, I would say, the setup of some informal collection systems, waste pickers, picking the waste and bringing it back to a collection center so it can be recycled. In Europe, we have, a, I would say, a very scattered landscape. You see in Germany, for example, where you have a deposit return system. So 97-98% of the PET bottles consumed are coming mechanically back into the system. Or countries like France, where this is today not the case. So how can we create a movement so that we have kind of deposit return systems everywhere in Europe and across the more mature market? So that's the challenge we are facing. Now you are saying to me, that's a good story, Jürgen, but why are you sued by an NGO? How is this possible? The reality is that this is the consequence of a French law, which is only applicable to a company which is headquartered in France. So obviously, there is, I would say, if you want to create a bit of noise around the topic, and I support the fact to create noise because we really need to change our business model to more sustainable practices, this is the way to do it.
Just as a reminder for the audience, please use the QR code if you want to get to your questions in a few seconds. So we've talked about plastics.
Can I add one element, Bruno, to that one? Because sometimes we talk about plastics and making business models sustainable as a license to operate. Like you need to do it because you took a commitment. You need to do it because you are the community, the public opinion leaders demand it. I believe it will also translate into competitive opportunities. When you look at what we did in Volvic in Germany, we went as first into 100% recycled material. We won market share because consumer is looking for that. So how we can translate all these initiatives into something which the consumer really values. And this is where A&P spends, communicating on the things you do, talking about the fact that Actimel doesn't have a sleeve anymore in order to protect the environment, makes a difference. So we need to better combine sustainable business models with product superiority in the eyes of the consumer.
On sustainability, you've talked about plastics, packaging, you have greenhouse gas emissions, there's 2030 targets, a lot of them coming. As a CFO, do you worry about the growing cost increases that it will put onto the business?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. If you only look at sustainability as a cost, That's wrong. If you only try, if you have conversations which are on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, on Thursday, on your P&L, outside of sustainability, on Friday, you talk about sustainability investments, it's wrong. Let's take the example of, Morocco, where we have a large dairy business, where we are now transitioning to regenerative agriculture practices. Very important for us, very important for the government, very important for the communities. The fact that we are the pioneer helping our farmers to move into regenerative agricultural practices, you can read every single day in the press. Every single day in the press. It makes our brand in Morocco truly different and superior. So we need to find ways to invest into superiority, to invest into sustainability, but to make it seen. This is very important. Second element, what is the cost for Danone to move to sustainable practices? It's about farming, because we are, in the end, we are consuming a lot of milk and agricultural ingredients, and about packaging, right? Good news, investment into the agri-food sector is one of the key priorities of governments around the world. It's one of the topics of the COP28, which will happen in a couple of months. So there will be flowing capital into that element, because we know food is at the center of the sustainability of the world. I mean, that's just what it is. So we will have a lot of support. The fact that we got a $70 million grant in the U.S. by the FDA to help us going to regenerative farming practices is a very good proof point that we are also able to attract external capital to help us moving into the right direction. So I don't see it as a cost. For me, it's really an element which we need to manage in a smart manner, but in the end, it needs to translate into stronger cash flows, and this not only in 10 years from now, next year, in 2 years, in 3 years.
I was trying to put you on the spot 5 years from now. So you don't think in 5 years from now there will be discussions where people will say, yeah, there's margin pressure because of the cost of sustainability that's hitting.
I believe there will be pressure. No, I think there will be two sides of companies. There will be companies who succeed because they will do it in a collective manner, like us. We do it with our farmers. We do it with the local governments. We do it with NGOs. We invest in a very targeted manner, and we translate it into better products, which can demand a premium price. And there will be companies which only see it as a cost, and who will try to cut somewhere else their investments, maybe in A&P. We want to belong to the first one, because I believe that financial performance without sustainability will not work. You need to invest into sustainability. But I also believe that sustainability without financial performance has a future. So I truly believe that we can bind both in a very meaningful manner.
So the investor question, so what was behind the portfolio management mistakes of the past, SKU bloat that is now being rationalized, and what will prevent them from recurring in the future?
Yes, I believe that that's at the core of what we've been doing over the last 12 months. For many years, especially in dairy, because this is where there was most pressure, there's been a real proliferation trying to match what the small companies were doing. You were talking about all these startup companies bringing very innovative products on the shelf. We were trying to mimic this. We were trying to mimic it, which makes no sense, because it means that you are coming with very small innovations on the shelf. You have hundreds and thousands of new SKUs. You bring complexity into your factories, complexity into your supply chain. You spread your A&P about many, many SKUs, and in the end you get nothing for it because things are dying. That's behind us. The fact that we have cutting the innovation pipeline by 30%, the fact that we are now setting the thresholds very high on new innovations, the fact that we do not innovation anymore for Germany, then for UK another one, then for France another one, but we are looking at it in a more regional manner, is changing our life. So we will manage our portfolio in a much more narrow and optimized manner, because we believe that is the keys to success.
What is the outlook for the waters division given enhanced consumer concerns over disposable plastics?
Yes, that's a very, very good question, because when we take the film back to 2019, before COVID, there was a lot of discussion about plastics, sustainability of plastics, and so on. When you today look at the consumption of mineral water, in Europe, you look at consumption of mineral bottled water. In the UK, we are the same level as 5 years ago. So there has been a lot of debate. The reality is that people have not changing really their consumption habits. And I would say even the opposite. We see more and more away from home consumption, because more and more people are on the go. So our small bottles in waters are booming. What will happen in the future is the question. And I believe that there's two dynamics which will happen. People will be more and more conscious about the water they consume. At home, if they consume mineral water, they will want the best mineral water. They will come to Evian, they will look at what we are doing there, they will only drink Evian water. And they will go on the go, and this is where you need to be at the right occasion, at the right price. That will make a difference. So in that sense, we are looking with a lot of optimism into that category. I would not say the same if I would play in the bottom part of that category. Low price, competing against tap water, low level of differentiation. But this is not what we want to do. Premium mineral water from a precious source, protected source, best water in the world, sold at a good price, in the right occasion. This is our strategy.
I think with that, we've run out of time. Jürgen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruno. Thank you very much, guys, for coming. Thank you.
Thank you.